First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
A Beaches community leads on green building. Good morning. We are live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this morning, the city of Atlantic Beach, a world leader in the sustainability space, will tell you why. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, it's a conversation with TV host Chris Hansen of To Catch a Predator fame. His new show, True Crime Nation, spotlights some cases, you guessed it, here in Florida. Plus, the candidates for Jacksonville mayor meet what they had to say. That's later this morning. But first this hour, a sustainable milestone for One Beaches community. The city of Atlantic Beach has achieved LEED Gold certification and is the first city in the world to recertify under the LEED for Cities and Communities rating system. Now, Atlantic Beach is part of a growing coalition of more than 300 local governments and communities all across the world to be certified using this LEED for Cities rating system. There are now 20 LEED certified local governments in Florida. What is LEED certification and why does it matter? We're taking a closer look just as another global climate summit concludes over in the Middle East. But we're having a local conversation as we welcome Kevin Hogenkamp, Deputy City Manager of Atlantic Beach. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
And Sarah Boren. She's a member of Atlantic Beach's Environmental Stewardship Committee and former staffer with the U.S. Green Building Council. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you both here in studio. What are your questions about LEED certification and Atlantic Beach leading in more ways than one? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. Well, Kevin, let's begin with you. Atlantic Beach has achieved LEED Gold certification, and LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And you are the first city in the world to recertify under a LEED for Cities and Communities rating system. For people that don't know what all that means, can you explain why this matters?
Sure thing. And Sarah, as a member of our Environmental Stewardship Committee, helped champion this effort. And I'm really excited to talk about why it matters. And Sarah has a good rundown on what LEED recertification is.
So I'll start with recertification. So back in 2019, we certified under the pilot, and it was where we measured 14 major parameters, both in kind of energy, water, waste, transportation, and human experience. And then we won a grant from Bank of America and U.S. Green Building Council to recertify. And we said, okay, we're gonna try this under a much more robust, rigorous system called version 4.1. And it made us really assess our, you know, holistic approach to sustainability and resilience. And we found some gaps, and we've already doing some great stuff. So that's what we mean by recertification. We kind of went under the pilot, and then we recertified under a more rigorous system.
Okay, so a more rigorous system, meaning how buildings are built or how buildings are retrofitted. Can you give some examples of what this literally means in the real world?
Sure.
Yeah.
So LEED for Cities is actually different from LEED Building. So what we're translating what we achieved in the building sector to the city and community level. So it's on a much different scale. It's more the 60,000-foot view, and you mean. So it's like the city was able to measure how much greenhouse gases emissions it had, what its waste diversion rate was, how many gallons of water per capita, all that kind of got baseline measurements. So it's a performance measurement framework. And it's holistic and integrated. So you address your natural systems and ecology, transportation and land use, water efficiency, energy and greenhouse gas emissions, materials and resources, quality of life, and then where City of Atlantic Beach did exceptionally well was under innovation and regional priority credits.
Okay, so what is Atlantic Beach doing that's innovative?
So good governance is planning ahead, and it's having good data to make its decisions. It's prioritizing based on identifying where we're at before we decide where we want to be. So when we established our vision, our mission, every year when we establish our priorities, the city commission and the city administration have identified environmental leadership, resiliency, sustainability, mm-hmm. as one of the things that every year, year in and year out, that we're going to strive toward.
And how difficult, how challenging is it to meet all of these targets and change the way you do things? I would think it'd be pretty tough because cities tend to be like any other institution. They kind of get used to doing things a certain way. This is radical change.
Yeah. So one of the things I love about LEAD is that it kind of forces collaboration across departments, makes people talk to each other, measure the same data in the same methodology. And Kevin and I were talking on the way in here, you know, one of the things that sold me on LEAD for Cities was Atlanta had this like really ambitious goal of 90% waste aversion rate, like, you know, how to reduce their waste, but they didn't even know their baseline, right? And they were down in like the 20%. So it's helping measure where you're really at and then defining goals and where you want to go. And to what Kevin was saying, we have in our community action plan, which is now basically implementing all that we learned through the LEAD for Cities certification, we're going to continually improve. But yes, it forces change. It identifies gaps, and you can work on where you can improve.
And where do you think the city or any city in our listening area could improve? How can other cities, particularly the city of Jacksonville itself, follow your lead? Your LEAD and your LEED. What are some ways cities could be doing better? What are some easy wins?
I think the first thing is to identify where that particular local government is at in terms of health and safety, knowing what your median air quality index is. You can't establish where you want to go until you know where you are. Equitability. What's your median rent? Percentage to ratio and your income differential. You have to know, and this is what we did and spent a couple years doing, mm-hmm. is establishing our benchmarks before we established our goals. And now we're better prepared to budget for the future.
And how expensive is it to make these kinds of changes?
You know, it's as expensive as the community decides ultimately. Mm-hmm. I think the science, the data that's out there is if we do this right, there's a return on investment, and that it'll be money well spent and will be rewarded in the long term.
That's important, I think, because when you talk about green building or LEED certification, or just decarbonizing in general, people and organizations resisting all of that say, it costs too much. People like you say, it's going to cost us a lot more if we don't.
Yeah, I think in action, measuring not doing something and the bill getting larger and larger later down the line is something that's hard to quantify sometimes. But as we've known, that study came out with Jacksonville. We're one of the most vulnerable with sea level rise, right? And there's a huge price tag to that. So I think also the other argument is that people don't realize that there's benefits in doing actions. Like you not only save money, but you have higher quality of life. You have higher staff morale. You have deeper community engagement, et cetera. One thing I wanted to turn back on the innovation side, I'm really proud of Atlantic Beach on its innovation with its tree canopy, you know, with kind of state preemption tendencies. The city of Atlantic Beach worked really hard on its tree ordinance, and it came up with, an AB verified tree program. So it helps tree companies coming in knowing the ordinance and what they're up, not just kind of claiming ignorance. We have a beach littering program where you have a basket and you can walk and pick up the litter. And then that we also have a polystyrene prohibition for city operations.
Oh, wow. Oh, so it's so many things.
Yeah.
All working together.
It is. Very.
What are your questions about this, everybody? The number to join us, 549-2937. Our guest in studio, Kevin Hogenkamp, Deputy City Manager of Atlantic Beach. Sarah Bourne, formerly with the U.S. Green Building Council and a member of Atlantic Beach's Environmental Stewardship Committee. Okay, as we have this conversation, it's in the aftermath of the world failing to reach an agreement to phase out fossil fuels after marathon climate talks in Egypt were stonewalled by a number of oil-producing nations. Negotiators from nearly 200 countries at the COP27 UN Climate Summit in Egypt, they took the historic step of agreeing to set up what they call a loss and damage fund to help vulnerable countries cope with climate disasters. And they agreed we need to cut greenhouse gas emissions nearly in half by the year 2030. That's in less than 10 years. They reaffirmed the goal of keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. However, the whole thing ended in a fiasco because companies like China and Saudi Arabia blocked a key proposal to phase out all fossil fuels, not just coal. So, as cities like Atlantic Beach and other Florida cities and other municipalities, hundreds around the world, are trying to do what they can, there's this overwhelming obstacle globally to getting us where we need to go. So I'd like to get both of your thoughts on that. Sarah Boren.
So I think it's all about local right now in a lot of ways. And I think it's local with cities, but also local as your individual choices. So cities can do a lot. I also think there's a lot of market shift happening. So we've got electric vehicles. We have infrastructure. Mm-hmm. We have the real estate sector with environmental, social, and governance metrics really driving their metrics and their investments. They don't want that risk. They don't want to invest in a property mm-hmm. that is subject to flooding or could be in the near future. So I think there's some major market shifts happening. But mm-hmm. at the local level, cities can really inspire and just get started. For instance, and it doesn't have to be mandated. It can be a voluntary benchmarking program. Have everybody kind of look at their energy bills and then individually and then as a city provide incentives on how they can reduce their energy bills or their water bills and have a healthier home or office space.
Kevin Hogenkamp, what about that? You're setting an example in Atlantic Beach. Once a community like yours really gets out in front, you sort of provide a roadmap for other city leadership, right?
Yes, it's been fun being identified as a leader in this arena. As to Sarah's point, it starts with our residents. Our gold certification started with our residents who our city leaders, our city commissioners heard. And when they established their priorities, one of the commissioners just threw it out there. Why don't we pursue LEED certification? And a lot mm-hmm. of us kind of scratched our head. But to our city commission's credit, Commissioner Kelly's idea of a bit, and this is almost 5 years later, and we're being recertified. So it starts locally through mm-hmm. Engagement, advocacy. It takes a political and administrative components of our government to listen and to follow up and follow through.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everything worthwhile starts locally.
And what do you hear from the residents of Atlantic Beach about this? How important is it to them?
Well, one of the things our residents seem to be doing is speaking through their votes. So every election, it seems as though the candidates are pushing for resiliency, sustainability, and they're supporting those candidates. It's something that our residents are particularly brilliant, and they're making good decisions, and they're active, and we have a group of those. Sarah and others who get directly involved on our environmental stewardship committee.
Any pushback, any criticism?
I'm not aware of any criticism about what we're doing in the arenas of resiliency and mm-hmm. sustainability.
Particularly beaches communities are going to be the first to feel the worst effects of rising waters, although our inland communities certainly have too. This is important for our coastal communities.
It is. And I'm really proud of Atlantic Beach for getting a vulnerability assessment done. We now know where we're most likely to flood. And so then they can prioritize their capital investment projects to meet those A lot of it is on actually on our marsh side. You think it's on the beach side, which we did lose a lot of our beach recently with both storms. But knowing where to prioritize really, really helps. And then as far as community feedback, we did a community survey, and it was very positive. They like a very high majority says, oh, my gosh, we need to address all these topics, you know, in an integrative way. And a lot of them also really want like compost and waste. They want to do what they have control over. Mm-hmm. So I found that pretty interesting.
549-2937. May on the south side. Hi, May. Good morning.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Really well, thanks. Hope you're well, too.
Doing well enough. I visited Rwanda, where they do not permit throwaway plastic bags. And sure enough, my suitcase was checked, and they confiscated the one I put in there just for a test run.
Wow.
10% of petroleum is used to make those plastic bags.
Mm-hmm.
So we could cut it 10% just getting rid of the throwaway plastic bags. Even though we all use them for all different things, we could really find something else to put stuff in. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, some cities have banned them. In Florida, the state government does not allow local cities to ban plastic bags. St. Augustine, I think, tried to ban that product, and the state told them, no, you're not going to do that. We won't let you do that.
Yeah, on that point, we were recently given the green light from the state to ban smoking in parks and on the beach, and enacting local legislation, to May's point, is a great way to start.
Yeah.
And to give a shout out to a local nonprofit, Beaches Go Green counted 180,000 cigarette butts found on the beach. So it's a littering problem. It's a problem for our sea turtles, et cetera.
Now, as May, thank you for that. And as May pointed out, if you're listening to this conversation and you're thinking, what can I do? What impact can I make? Honestly, if you do nothing else, try to use fewer plastic bags. It was a huge habit change for me, because when you go to the grocery store, you don't really think much about it. You just take the groceries home. But over time, I got into the habit of keeping cloth bags in the back of my SUV. Every time I go to the store, I just bring them in. When I first started doing this almost 10 years ago, the checkout people, unless you were at a place like Whole Foods, they were kind of confused. Like, why are you doing this? Why are you giving me these cloth bags? Now it's so common that they know. A lot of people prefer to use cloth bags. If that's the only change you make in your life, you are doing your part, because disposable plastic bags are really bad. They really do a lot of damage. So anything you can do to minimize those kinds of products, putting more of those products into the environment, is a good thing. Carol in San Marco. Hi, Carol.
Yes, hi. Congratulations to both your guests. I'm so proud of being part of a community that is LEED certified and has these values. But I had a question. Have they quantified the effect of this official LEED certification for that community on individuals' property values? I know the property values in Atlantic Beach are very high. So is that part of the reason, or are the property values going to improve? How's it affected?
Yeah, thanks for that. That's a great question.
Hi, Carol. I actually know Carol.
Oh, okay.
I recognize her voice. I think I'll see her on Thanksgiving.
Very nice.
So great question. In a larger sense, so agencies like Moody's look at a city's debt ratio, as well as their risk to resiliency or flooding or hurricanes, et cetera, and the ability for the city to kind of put up more collateral for their debt, to borrow more money.
Mm-hmm.
So when you keep your property safe, you keep your property taxes safe, which allows Moody's to then allow the city to grow and invest in more projects. So they're at a time in the future, Atlantic Beach might need to borrow money for a bond to improve something. And this really helps retain property values. There's other things that citizens can do to reduce their flooding on site with green infrastructure, bioswales, et cetera, raising up their properties. I know, you know, huge congrats to the city of city of Jacksonville for hiring a chief resiliency officer.
Yeah.
You know, leading up to that hire, we had a lot of experts weigh in, local experts, but also we had speakers come in, and we had this one, we had FEMA speak to us. We had this one gentleman talk to about how raising properties retains property values. So we haven't quantified it specifically, though there's lots, there's 20 cities in Florida that are probably beginning to think about that, but it does, by reducing your risk to shocks and continual stressors, you maintain property
values. And does preemption by Tallahassee complicate this process for Florida cities? The state coming in and telling, and bigfooting cities who try to make these changes.
I will say I think so, because it squashes innovation, right? And cities do still have the ability to, you know, whatever they have control over. So the polystyrene prohibition is on their city operations. They couldn't put it on, you know, everything in the city, right? They couldn't demand all our businesses, but, you know, the vendors that are come onto city properties, they could. So, but what if that was at a larger scale? More innovation. I mean, if you think about all the brain trust we have in each of our cities and citizens thinking outside of the box and providing solutions, I think that's what kind of chills the preemption does. So I understand kind of having one policy for the whole state for, you know, economic reasons and stuff like that. But I think that there are ways to foster innovation. The other thing I want to say is, by preemption, I think it reduces, it slows down acceleration of adoption of sustainability and resiliency measures.
Here's an email from MG. I was just in the state of Washington in Seattle. The entire state mandates that all retailers charge 8 cents a bag, period. That's one way to incentivize people not to use plastic bags as much. Bill in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Bill.
Hey. Melissa, I think monocropping is probably our biggest issue. Growing a single crop and not in the farming industry, a lot of the stuff that's farmed is used for everything from ethanol to feeding cattle, et cetera, et cetera. And they don't grow any other crops on that land, so the photosynthesis doesn't take place. They're not tilling the soil, replanting year-round. That would capture the majority of the carbon that can eventually heat us up beyond livable.
Well, I appreciate that, Bill. You know, when it comes to decarbonizing, I readily admit I'm not a climate scientist. I'm sure that's part of the solution, along with the big lift, which is getting countries to decarbonize. And that's a huge lift, getting countries, getting everyone off fossil fuels, getting a utility like JEA to move more rapidly toward renewables, which they're doing. But the people that track emissions and the danger from emissions say they're not doing it quickly enough. Go ahead.
Speaking of JEA, they're in the middle of their integrated resource plan, developing it. So they have to develop a 30-year plan. So I recommend everybody going to JEA and looking at that plan and providing comments. I also want to, again, you know, cheer Atlantic Beach for its tree canopy commitment, because trees have so many benefits, not only for habitat and, you know, animals and et cetera, but it's a stormwater measure, as well as it increases real estate value, reduces energy bills. I mean, there's just so many great attributes.
Yeah, so many benefits to that.
Extreme heat. I actually took a thermometer while I was walking one day, and I, you know, put it down on the pavement in the sun and in the shade. There was a 12-degree difference.
Greenscape of Jacksonville is one organization working to increase the tree canopy, too. Charlie in St. John's. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. I really approve of the LEED certification on Atlantic Beach, and I heard a mention about cigarette butts. Like over 180,000 or some were found on local beaches. Has there ever been any ordinances that would make littering of cigarette butts, certainly throwing a lit cigarette butt out of your car, especially in fire-prone areas? I mean, it's funny, I'm wearing my Smokey the Bear shirt as I'm speaking, but it would seem that local ordinances or even something nationally should be done about cigarettes being just thrown, especially lit ones. Any comment there?
I don't know if that's your bailiwick, Kevin.
Well, we'd love to hear. We'd love to hear from anyone with any ideas. A lot of our ideas start with an email or a phone call to us, and we'll look into it.
Yeah. And I want to thank you both. Happy Thanksgiving. Kevin Hogenkamp, Deputy City Manager, Atlantic Beach. Sarah Bourne on the Atlantic Beach Environmental Stewardship Committee. Congrats.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both. And much more still ahead later. Lighting up St. Augustine in more ways than one this holiday season, but up next.
And we have some new predator investigations, one of which we did in Polk County, Florida, not too far from Orlando, not too far from you.
He first rose to fame as the host of To Catch a Predator. We go inside Chris Hansen's new show, True Crime Nation. We'll be right back. Well, host Chris Hansen of To Catch a Predator fame is debuting a new series over the Thanksgiving holiday on the True Blue streaming network. True Crime Nation takes viewers inside the most compelling crime stories where they will see and hear things they will experience nowhere else. Hansen also profiles several cases in Florida. He gave me this preview.
Chris Hansen, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. How's everything in Florida?
Really good. And I understand your new show looks at some cases in Florida. Tell us about True Crime Nation with Chris Hansen.
Well, True Crime Nation is a new news magazine that's going to focus on crime, and that's going to be a part of our new crime streaming network, True Blue, which premieres Thanksgiving Day. And we have a number of investigative documentaries that we're working on for that. And we have some new predator investigations, one of which we did in Polk County, Florida, not too far from Orlando, not too far from you. So it's amazing to me that all these years into the predator investigations that we still have people showing up to meet teens for an illicit liaison.
Well, tell us about this Polk County case, because I understand you were embedded with law enforcement to look into this?
Exactly. So the Polk County Sheriff's Office, led by Sheriff Grady Judd, is very proactive in this area. And I've known the sheriff for many years, back from my days as a reporter in Tampa. And I had approached him about, you know, embedding in an operation and watching, seeing how they do it, and then have an opportunity to, you know, actually talk to the suspects themselves, which I did, which was eye-opening. And, you know, we had a situation, Melissa, where these guys would ask in the chat with somebody who they thought was a teenage boy or girl if this was a Chris Hansen deal. And the decoy would say, well, who's that? And he said, well, and he'd explain what the predator story has been like for the last 18 years. But they would show up anyway. And then they would talk to me, each and every one of these predators who showed up in this sting actually sat down for a lengthy interview.
Why do you think they do it?
You know, it's a very good question. I think some of them, believe it or not, some of them get a little bit starstruck. And they have seen the shows. They have watched my other stories over the years. They listen to the podcast. They watch my appearances. And they actually accept the fact that, okay, I did this. And now it's time to talk to Chris Hansen. And, you know, not everybody completely confesses. A lot of guys just want to tell their story of how they were misunderstood or how they're just coming to help the child or this is some sort of a Good Samaritan thing, people still think they can get away with that excuse. But some of them just straight out confess. And we had the case of one guy, Matthew Bongean, who's in the Orlando area, all the way from Hemet, California, on a training job-type-related seminar. And he's trolling around the internet one night, and he's trying to meet a 12-year-old girl.
Hmm.
And he shows up, and he had asked whether or not this was a sting. He shows up. He's arrested. I get a chance to interview him. And he completely confesses and explains in his own words why he was there, what he was thinking, and why he wanted to do what he was trying to do. And it's almost like a Silence of the Lambs moment. You know, it was really eerie, and he had this very bizarre laugh about him. It really takes the viewer inside the world of this crime, and you actually watch it being committed. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so compelling, is that people actually see the commission of a felony in real time, and then they see the predator, the criminal, held accountable.
Well, of course, you are one of the foremost TV and digital personalities working in this kind of space, helping bring these investigations to light, helping catch predators. Why do you think this remains such a media fascination? What is it that we're missing in the culture on the law enforcement side that we need to use the media to, you know, bring some of these cases to light?
Well, I think law enforcement is trying its best to curtail this problem by doing sting operations. You know, we've been on operations in the Midwest, in Florida, as we just discussed, in the Southwest, on the West Coast. And the internet and the issue is so ubiquitous. And when you think about this for a second, when we started doing these investigations 18 years ago, we merely had decoys and chat rooms on AOL and Yahoo. Mm-hmm. Well, today, the number of social media platforms has exploded. It's hard to even keep track of. And so it's much harder to monitor, which means there's more opportunity for adults who want to prey on children to find them. We had a case in Michigan where a 12-year-old girl was just on Instagram, approached and groomed by an adult in Florida who came up and traveled to see her and sexually assaulted her. And that case finally was prosecuted. So law enforcement is vigilant, but there's just so much of it going on that I think it's important to stay on top of the reporting to create this awareness, this dialogue. And I think by getting inside the mind of a predator, whether it's this kind of a predator or a financial predator or anything else, in hearing the voice of a victim, you can better prevent other people from becoming victims. And we do this immersive type reporting, this enterprise reporting, where we take people inside of the crime, where they hear things they would normally hear, they see things they wouldn't normally see. And I think it's important. I think it's an experience that, you know, while dark, obviously, it's something that can enlighten people and ultimately protect people.
Now, with all of that said, how can people catch the new show?
People can go to watchtrueblue.com. which is Watch, TRUBLU, and it's a crime streaming network, just like, you know, Netflix or any others that you'll be able to access. And if you go to the website, it'll walk you through it, how to get it, how to see it, how to subscribe, and all that kind of good stuff. So we'll have not just the Predator investigations, but several other incredible crime documentaries that we're working on. And one of the great things about this world of streaming is that we can be very nimble, and we can react very quickly to crime stories, which we will do on True Crime Nation as well, which will initially be a part of True Blue. So, for instance, when I've done documentaries over the past couple of years for some of the larger networks, they can take 12, 18, sometimes 24 months to turn around. And in this format, partnering with Transition Studios, as I have, Sean Reck, who did the White Boy Rick documentary, and so many others, we can react very quickly, and I can do these things in a matter of weeks or months. So we're basically applying the same enterprising techniques that we did to these investigations, that we have been to these investigations for so many years, to the distribution of this content, and I think it's going to be very compelling for people who want the content.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Chris Hansen, his new series, True Crime Nation, is streaming on the True Blue streaming network. Check it out. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
Well, there are nine candidates now running to become the next mayor of Jacksonville. Lenny Curry, of course, is termed out. The election isn't set until next spring, but the first official forum in the mayor's race took place yesterday at the downtown Rotary Club. Most of the candidates showed up. WJCT News' Raymond Troncoso was there, and he's here to fill us in. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right, so seven of the nine mayoral candidates came to this Rotary Forum. How did it go?
Well, the format was very constraining. You had just an hour to get to each of these seven candidates. It was a very crowded stage, and it was hard for people to talk about, you know, their main issues. I think the most important thing is it kind of gave us a glimpse of how the campaign's going to go going forward, more so than it really revealed the stances of each candidates.
And by that, you mean?
Well, we know that Leanna Cumber, she's going hard on Daniel Davis. He, of course, was not there. He was one of the two candidates who did not show up, yet he was the main topic. Every time she was asked a question, she would always bring it back to, you know, Daniel Davis isn't here. He doesn't care about Jacksonville, and he's wrong on this issue.
So, and he's the Jack's chamber chair. He's raised the most money in this race. The one viable candidate that didn't show up, Leanna Cumber, of course, is on the city council. Here's Cumber going after Daniel Davis's absence and his positions. Just one example.
I fought against doubling the gas tax that Daniel Davis funded and supported and the other taxes that have been passed in the city in the last 7 years. He thinks he's already won. That's why Daniel's not here, because he thinks it's owed to him.
Okay, let's expand on that a little bit. Leanna Cumber is really running to the right of Daniel Davis in the Republican lane, trying to peel off some traditional Republican support. This is probably going to go to a runoff election with two candidates making it into the second round. Most likely, not guaranteed, but most likely a Republican and a Democrat if tradition holds. Leanna Cumber's trying to knock Davis out of the Republican lane and maybe make it into the runoff against the Democrat, it sounds like.
Yeah, that seems to be the strategy. But remember, there's no guarantee. So we have this first, the way Jacksonville works is every candidate runs at the same time. You're going to have all nine in this first race in March. And the top two, assuming no one gets to beyond 50.0001%, it's going to go to that runoff election in May. And that does seem the strategy is for her to try to court conservative voters mm-hmm. who might be more in favor of the small government, lower taxes that she's kind of going for. Well, Daniel Davis, who's also running as a Republican, is saying, you know, he's about business development, bringing businesses to Jacksonville, rejuvenating Jacksonville. And the way he says to do that is, you know, these incentive plans that give big tax breaks to companies coming here and to raise taxes for an infrastructure project that he's been behind, as Cumber said, for the past 7 years.
Now, on the Democratic side, former news anchor and Marathon founder Donna Deegan on the dais, along with former state Senator Audrey Gibson, those are the two leading Democrats in the race. What did they have to say?
Yeah, so if we're going by polling and we're actually considering candidates, Donna Deegan does seem to be the favorite. She has the highest, she's the most recognizable candidate in the field. The most recent polling we have from UNF last month had her at 22%. That's way higher than the next highest, which is Daniel Davis at around 7%. Of course, the one box that people ticked the most was that, you know, I either don't support any of the above or I don't know any of the candidates. So it's still a wide open race. Mm-hmm. Audrey Gibson polling at about 6%. She's a former state senator, pretty well known in Jacksonville, just not as much as Donna Deegan, it seems.
Who else was there and did they have anything interesting to say?
Well, you had a Frank Kiesler Jr., who's the most right-wing candidate on stage, which was probably a surprise to Al Ferrero, who's also someone who's trying to run, you know, a race to the right of the other candidates. Al Ferrero is someone who, you know, on the council has made an issue about attempts to take down Confederate statues. Mm-hmm. Frank Kiesler Jr. went a little bit farther than that, saying that the city council needs to stop pandering to and patronizing the Black community. So he made a couple stump speeches to that end, which from the audience reaction didn't really get a huge support, you could say. But yeah, the other candidates are also, you know, Omega Allen, Teresa Ann Richardson, Darcy Richardson, people who have very different agendas. But we'll see if they can make a splash in the race. It seems that at the moment, people are more concerned with the people that we've mentioned so far, at least in terms of polling, is Donna Deegan, Daniel Davis, Leanna Cumber, Audrey Gibson. But with 9 candidates and still, you know, 4 months until that first primary, there's still a chance for any of these candidates to make a splash.
Yeah. And of course, in the end, a lot of money is going to be spent, historic amounts of money for a local mayoral election.
I mean, when we're talking about war chest, just Daniel Davis alone, you know, head of the Jacks Chamber, was a city council member, has deep roots in Jacksonville to the business community because of his position as Jacks Chamber. He's already raised $5 million, and we're still 4 months out from that first race. If he makes it to the runoff, we're expecting him to raise even more. Leanna Cumber, who's was kind of a dark horse in terms of the fundraising, she has the second biggest war chest, $3 million. And of course, Donna Deegan, it looks like in terms of fundraising that she's lagging behind. She has a little less than $700,000. But still, she has a lot of name recognition that kind of already puts her up there, that she doesn't really need to spend as much money to be well known because she was a news anchor for so many years. And she's mm-hmm. also famous for her philanthropy efforts.
Yeah. Now, anything else that came out at this forum? Because let's face it, after the midterm elections, now voters are going to be asked to go out and vote again in March, which isn't typically a high turnout cycle. Anything else people should know about some of these candidates as they're just starting to tune in to this mayor's race?
Well, if you want to know their stances on these issues, they were asked 4 questions on crime, business development, the St. John's River, mm-hmm. education, you know, how the mayor interacts with the school board. We're going to have all of the answers verbatim in the candidates' own words on our website.
Great.
That you can go check out later today so you can get to know some of the candidates. Maybe because of local reporting, you've only ever heard of Donna Deegan or Daniel Davis. This might give you a chance to get to know some of the candidates. You know, that's why we went there. That's why we reported on it. Like you said, it's right before the holidays. We're probably not going to see another debate until maybe January, until after the new year. So this kind of gave people a chance to kind of get to know the candidates, but I wouldn't expect this to shake up the race too much. I think what people should know is there's a lot of candidates. There's a lot of mudflinging that's going to go around. Donna Deegan put it this way: I've been called everything but a child of God so far in this race. So expect a brutal campaign. If we've seen any indication tonight, candidates are not going to be shy about going after each other, even when they're not there. So we should expect that in this campaign going forward.
Raymond Troncoso, and you can read his full accounting of all of the candidates running for Jack's mayor at wjctnews.org.
And Jack's Thank Today.
You. And at jackstoday.org. Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you.
Thank you.
And when we come back, how St. Augustine is lighting up for the holidays in more ways than one. That's next.
Interest rates aren't bad for everybody, you know.
While that is troublesome for borrowers, you know, it's a great news story for our savers.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the good and the bad of higher rates, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9. state laws have put limits on abortion options for many women. That's increased the sales of mail-order abortion pills from the Netherlands.
Telemedical abortion care, so abortion care with pills through the mail, it's now officially allowed by the FDA.
I'm Marco Werman. That story next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. Growing up, tap dance great Iodelli Cassell adored Ginger Rogers. She even got an autographed 8x10 from her.
However happy and joyful I was, like, living my Ginger dream, I was like, nobody is ever going to see, you know, me, Black and Puerto Rican girl from the Bronx, as a tap dancing Hollywood star.
Iodelli Cassell on This Moment for Women of Color in Tap, next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
More Americans across the age spectrum are living together under one roof. In fact, multi-generational living has doubled since the 1970s. Finances and family are two key drivers. On the next 1A, we'll share your stories and hear why this trend has been called a game changer, not just for people, but for the planet.
Today at 11 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, after visits to New York's Rockefeller Plaza and London's Hyde Park, the world-famous Light the World mobile giving machine is coming to Florida this holiday season. Now, these bright red vending machines work in reverse by giving people a chance to buy much-needed items for local and global charities. If you go down to St. Augustine for Nights of Lights, you should check this out, too. It's another way to light up the nation's oldest city. Gail Susan Pennell is on the line. She's Communications Director for the LDS Church Jacksonville Coordinating Council. Good morning, Gail.
Hi, good morning.
Okay, so tell us about this. I hadn't heard of this until recently. What is the Light the World mobile giving machine?
Well, Light the World is an initiative that we do at the church every year to try to kind of get people to think about others, to share their light, give hope, give love to other people, especially during the holiday season when people are more likely to think of other people. Mm-hmm. And the mobile giving machine is a way of encouraging people to give to others without to make it a fun event. It's like a real giving machine, a real vending machine that you go to. Mm-hmm. And it's full of goods and services for people, local charities and global charities that need help.
So it looks like a machine where I'd buy a 7-Up and a Snickers bar, but instead I'm choosing something that can help someone else. Is that right?
You can buy, socks or pajamas, or you can buy a chicken or a beehive or pillows and blankets or bedding or all different things for different kinds of charities. And this one's different because it's going to travel. So we're going to have it in St. Augustine for 5 days, and then it's going to move to 4 other locations in the South.
Now, it will be...
This is the first time we've ever had one in Florida.
Oh, really? And how did that happen? How did it come about that St. Augustine was chosen?
It was a process where we were asked to submit a bid to, a bid of how could we help the community in our area, and what locations, and could we get enough people that would be interested in visiting the giving machine? And then it was chosen randomly from, probably not randomly, from a group of cities that all nominated themselves.
Now, if you choose something, are you given a token or a voucher, or what exactly comes out of the machine?
Well, actually, what happens is you pick the item, and then the card with the item on it will fall to the bottom of the machine. You don't actually get to keep that item, but we have a little selfie area where you can take pictures of, what item that you chose. And we have little giveaways that will help you remember your Light the World giving expenses. We encourage people to take photos and make it a big event for them and their family.
That's great. Now, The Light the World mobile giving machine is coming to St. Augustine starting on Black Friday through Giving Tuesday. Where can people find it?
It is right at the St. Augustine Visitor Center, right where the Night of Lights trolleys pick up. So right where you wait in line, we're going to be right there. You'll be able to see it. We're going to be there all day and all night, so every day until Tuesday.
And what a perfect way to celebrate Nights of Lights with a little giving in addition to the holiday festivities. You picked, I think, the perfect time to kick this off, Gail.
I think it goes hand in hand with the theme of what St. Augustine likes to do with the Night of Lights.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Now, there's more at mobilegivingmachine.org if you want to check this out. And as you mentioned, the machine will go from St. Augustine to other locations around the Southeast. Is that right?
Right. The next location is Birmingham, Alabama, then Atlanta, Georgia, then Charlotte, North Carolina, and then ending up in Charleston, South Carolina, where they finish up on Christmas Eve. And you have the opportunity, if you can't travel to a machine, you can go online and check it out and see what it's all about. You can donate online if you have a charity you'd like to donate to.
Check it out, folks, in St. Augustine at the St. Augustine Visitor Center from Thanksgiving weekend's Black Friday through Giving Tuesday. During Nights of Lights, the Light the World mobile giving machine. Gail Susan Pennell, thank you for joining us to tell us all about it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Thanks also to David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, and Michelle Corum. I'm Melissa Ross. Drop me a line at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Thanks so much for listening. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.